Hello. Welcome to Literally from the North Shore, and thanks for tuning in. Today we are listening to Sins of Our Fathers, a novel by Sean Lawrence Otto, published in 2014 by Milkweed Editions. The audiobook version is broadcast with permission from Blackstone Audio.
In fact, the odds were even better now, when he thought about it. He held back his $300 nut and pushed the remaining $2,700 into the box. He could claw his way back up into 30, and this time he'd walk away, no matter what. Even at 30. He could imagine Carol's surprise and her relieved, happy smile at $30,000. He needed that happy smile. The money would solve so many problems, the silly mundanities that had been driving them apart. Two new players joined him at the table, an excited blonde in her 20s and her obsequious boyfriend. The dealer replenished the shoe, and J.W. slid his cards over the magic blue felt. Turned them up to look. A 5 and a 7. So he was at 12. The play cycled to the boyfriend, then the blonde, and no face cards came up, making his chance of getting one that much higher. Dealer could get one too. So he had a choice. He could sit at 12 and probably lose the 2,700, or he could take a hit. The odds were 2 to 1 he would survive, since face cards are only a third of the deck. "Hit me," he said. It was a jack. "Sorry, J.W.," the dealer said as she raked in his chips. He sipped his drink, then picked up his original $300. "No worries. All about the fun, right?" She nodded and dealt a new hand as another player took his place. He rode the glass and chrome escalator back down. Willie Nelson had gone, and the lines were long at all the teller windows, so he used the cashier booth in the center of the slots area. The whir of colors and ringing bells made him feel like he was standing inside a toy. The machines emitted friendly voices, as if he were at a vast cocktail party of single robots on the prowl. The blue hairs sat staring at them, sipping their cocktails and their red wines, and munching on pretzels as they pushed the spin buttons over and over. Spin, coin, spin, coin. Chink, chink. As J.W. stepped up to the cashier, he saw the woman across the aisle do something incredibly stupid. She left a dollar slot machine with a top dollar advisor feature and headed for the flashing light slot machine near the front. He couldn't believe it. The top dollar advisor was one of only two machines like it in the entire casino. It was rumored to have the highest payout percentage in the state, and so it was almost never available. He knew he should be getting on the road, but he had time for a few quick spins. He traded his chips for tokens and hurried to the prized stool, slipping in ahead of a man who was pushing his walker in the same direction. Immediately, he hit a payout and collected $20. "I think this round's on you," the machine said in the voice of Cliff Clavin from the old TV show Cheers, and the chorus sang, "Where Everybody Knows Your Name." He put the tokens in his keeper basket and played again.
"Congratulations," Cliff said cheerfully, while the display advised him of the upcoming odds.
If you paid attention, he knew. Over time, the top dollar advisor could help you beat the house. After another hour or so, he was still hanging in there. He was down to about $150, but he still had the 25 in winnings off to the side, so he wasn't doing too bad. Plus, he'd had a lot of fun and several more free drinks. The difference between guys like him and problem gamblers, he realized, was that he knew when to stop. He'd spent half his nut, so it was time to lock in his winnings and cash out. All in all, he was only down $125. It was a fair price for a night out having fun, and he'd had a couple free drinks and some food to boot. So it was less than $100, when you thought about it. Not bad for entertainment. He cashed out at the VIP window. See you tomorrow, the teller said. He shook his head. I'm not in here that often, he replied.
I know, she said, flushing.
She smiled, wrinkling up her nose.
Just wanted to say something to you. Have a good night.
As he passed the big winter mirror, he noticed how rounded his shoulders were. He stood up and pulled them back, stretching his shoulder blades. Like angel wings, the chiropractor had told him after Chris's accident. Back when his headaches were non-stop and he worried he had a brain tumor. He really needed to practice better posture. He used to have that naturally from training horses. It was probably the driving. He would exercise in the morning. That kind of self-discipline was something he'd always been good at. It had always been his secret weapon, in business and in life, his ability to pursue the goals he set with unwavering determination. He glanced at his watch. 10:57. He hurried to the car. Chapter 4. Carol and J.W.'s house was on a residential street opposite the city park. When he was a kid, the park had been groomed like a golf course. But in the 25 years since the mine closed, the city had gone longer and longer between mowings. As he pulled over, he saw dandelion heads glimmering like pale mold in the moonlight. It was the house of the fateful dinner, and now it was theirs. When Carol was pregnant with Chris, Bob and Mary announced that Bob had accepted a new job in Atlanta. They had purchased a condo there and were going to keep an apartment here in town. They were giving them the family home so that their grandchildren could grow up like Carol had, playing in the park until the squirrels scampered at dusk, and dreaming of England and being royal. The house was dark now, except for their second-floor bedroom window. The clock glowed dimly on his dash. 11:15. She was likely in bed reading or watching The Late Show. Perhaps it wasn't too late. He stepped out of the car and eased the door shut. He crossed the street. He would apologize. He had been delayed and he had forgotten to charge his cell phone, he would say. It had run out. How stupid of him. But as he headed up the walk, the window darkened. He continued on to the doorstep, where he saw his mail lying in a small bundle. A sticky note flapped in the breeze. John went to bed. Carol. He picked it up. He ran his fingers down the grooves of the doorframe's half-Roman column. Rousing her at this point would not end well. He stood quietly for a moment as his hopeful vision of the evening dissolved, wishing there were some way he could reverse time and power past the gravity of the casino. He turned back to his car. He sat there, outside his darkened house, then finally drove off into the night. Aside from a few bites at the casino, he hadn't eaten since breakfast. He stopped on the way home for gas and some food. He pulled a chuck wagon sandwich from behind the glass cooler door and stuck it in a microwave on the orange counter by the window. Outside, the local sheriff's deputy, a big bearish guy named Bob Grossman, had his red and blue lights flashing as he talked to a car full of kids parked in front of the store. He didn't look happy. The microwave dinged. J.W. pushed the greasy button and pulled out the hot plastic pillow, avoiding the steam emanating from the tear he had made in the corner. The police lights shone into the store as he made his way toward the counter, turning the customers faintly red, then blue. A bunch of Native American kids tumbled out of the car. He watched them jostle each other, laughing like they didn't care, as Grossman yelled at them. He set his sandwich on the counter. He had seen Grossman do this before. The Lions Club had even had him in to talk about what a hazard the reservation kids were and his strategy of keeping pressure on them. The boys ran wild and drank and caused problems ranging from burglary to traffic accidents. The dysfunction, addiction, and poverty of the reservation was a regular point of contention at Chamber of Commerce events.
where the more conservative members groaned about how the Native Americans lived in a welfare culture, while the liberal members said it was because of a cycle of poverty and broken families. Grossman was a member of the Rotary Club, the Chamber, and the Lions, and was widely felt to be the best check they had on the problem. Some people were talking about supporting him for sheriff when Big Bill Donovan retired. J.W. grabbed a few paper napkins from the dispenser next to the register. "Gas on three," he said. The cashier typed in the gas and bleeped through his food with a bored effect as J.W. studied the rolls of lottery tickets under the scratched plastic fog of the countertop.
"$31.49. Anything else?"
"Yeah. Give me 150 in scratch-offs. Loons." He felt embarrassed, as if he were asking for a copy of Penthouse. She pulled out a long streamer of shiny foiled tickets. The loons' backs glinted in the light. "Thanks," he said, folding them accordion style as he hurried out the door, forgetting his sandwich and drink inside. He stuffed the remaining bills and coins into his pocket, then headed past the Native American boys, who were clearly drunk. He thought about the wreckage his ancestors had caused by introducing alcohol to the Native Americans, and they by giving tobacco to whites. He scratched his thumbnail across a glistening loon to reveal the number sets. It was a loser, and got into his car, thankful that he didn't have those kinds of problems. His apartment building was just half a block farther up 6th, behind the Food and Fuel. It was on a narrow strip of land between 6th and the highway, just beyond Sabo's Guns. The building was long and short, clad in rough plywood siding, wavy from rain. Thin layers of it sloughed off like dead skin in the summer. The building had a crabgrass lawn and a gravel parking lot. A billboard loomed overhead, advertising Dr. Reed Orput, who could renew your confidence with a mouthful of dental implants. "Remake your life," it said, "with Dr. Reed and the Smile Factory." Orput's porcelain grin had become a navigation point for J.W., indicating where to turn. A much smaller sign at the parking lot entrance said, "Whispering Pines Apartments, your new home." Every time J.W. pulled past it, he was irritated by the misplaced apostrophe, but he hadn't gotten around to scratching it out. There were no pine trees on the property, but someone had once planted juniper bushes amid wood chips that were crumbling to soil next to the building's foundation. He approached the entrance carrying his briefcase, his bindered stack of mail, his keys, and his ribbon of spent lottery tickets. A large Walmart semi barreled past on the highway, buffeting him in its hot backwash. He twisted his key in the lock, pulled the glass open, and went inside. His apartment was on the second floor, 6 steps up from the street. Second-floor units cost $10 a month more than first-floor apartments. J.W. stuck a small key in his dented brass mailbox, but there was nothing inside. He headed up the stairs, his shoes sticking to the yellowing plastic runner. The hall smelled of borscht. His door was halfway down the hall on the right, the highway side. A bright orange piece of paper was stuck to it. "Eviction notice. You are hereby ordered to vacate your premises immediately due to non-payment of rent. Move now. Save court costs. Whispering Pines Management." An artery pulsed hot in his neck as he peeled the notice off. He heard clattering dishes from somewhere, a TV, late-night laughter with some woman. He wondered how many of the tenants had seen it, and wished management had simply called him. He went inside and tossed everything on the coffee table. The apartment was cheap anyway. That had been its advantage, and it came furnished. So when J.W. moved out of the house, he didn't have to buy all new furniture for a temporary separation while he and Carol worked on their marriage. Of course, tonight he may have blown that too, he thought. He turned on the TV and headed into the kitchen, a small galley that sloped sharply downhill toward the highway.
The announcer's voice boomed in the other room as he opened the fridge.
Baxter Pawn, Baxter Pawn, Baxter Pawn! Just 3 hours from almost anywhere and the largest selection in the upper Midwest!
He stared into the fridge's yellow interior and shook his head to regain his focus. Pig's Eye Pilsner, Red Owl Milk, Swanson TV Dinners, some bologna gone green. He took out a beer and closed the door. He wasn't a slob, J.W. thought, but he should be cooking. The fridge should have real food. Perhaps that was part of the problem. Not enough self-care. He had been spending too much time at the casino. He was a well-respected banker with a beautiful family. And yet, here he was, with no real sense of what he should do next. He turned and walked back across the slanted floor. Road construction on the highway had caused the building's foundation to bow inward. He had examined it one day while doing laundry on the first floor. It explained why the windows along the highway side would not open, and why the floor ran at a funhouse slant. This flaw presented the need for special adjustments. The legs of his bed were propped up on the roadside with chunks of 2x4s. In the kitchen, the fridge and the range both trudged uphill. The countertop tilted downhill. On his first day in the apartment, J.W. had come home to find his brand-new Walmart toaster oven in pieces on the floor. He returned to the living room. The pale green brocaded sofa emitted a sharp, dusty odor when he sat down. He grabbed the remote and changed channels to the Home Shopping Network. He ran through his ribbon of scratched-off loon tickets until he found the two winners. He tore them at the perforations and tossed them on the coffee table. $6 each. "Isn't it gorgeous?" the blonde saleswoman asked viewers as she modeled a cubic zirconium necklace. "What woman wouldn't fall in love with the man who gave her this?" He opened his first letter, a bill from Conexus, the local rural electric cooperative. "Disconnection notice. Your electricity will be disconnected for non-payment. You must call immediately." He set the mail down and rubbed his temples. Chapter 5. The following morning was fine and dry, and it felt warm as J.W. left the building. He pulled out onto 6th, heading for the highway. The city of North Lake had a scenic rusticity that owed much to its proximity to the west end of the Boundary Waters Canoe Area Wilderness, a vast, roadless expanse of hundreds of lakes along the border with Canada. Native lake names like Kekekabik, Ogishkimansky, and Gabamichigami fell easily from the tongues of Iron Rangers when they talked fishing, and the region attracted outdoor enthusiasts from around the world who wanted to experience an authentic American wilderness. Northwoods decor, log buildings with dark green roofs, colorful chalk sandwich boards changed daily by dreadlocked hipsters, Will Steger mucklucks, and tree stumps sculpted by chainsaws into bears and eagles all helped to attract eco-vacationers who injected cash into the local economy. North Lake Bank operated from a log building out on the main highway. It hadn't been built to appeal to the granola crowd. That was a happy accident. During the housing crisis, one of J.W.'s best customers, a log home builder, was suddenly left with several unsellable vacation homes he had built on spec. They were pitched up like derelicts along the vast shores of North Lake. When he fell behind on his payments, rather than liquidate his business at a certain loss, J.W. suggested he use his unsold inventory to construct a new building for the bank, thereby saving an important customer's business and solving the bank's space problem at a bargain basement price. The picturesque result had earned J.W. a feature article in Banking Magazine and a Community Banker of the Year nomination. Since then, business was up sharply. He pulled in, bumping up over the curb cut. A large carport supported by thick log posts and iron stanchions sheltered the drive-through lanes. The grounds were well landscaped, with a chainsaw sculpture of a leaping trout on the front strip of grass. He angled into a space marked by a small brass lawn sign that read, "President." The morning's rising heat hit him hard as he stepped out. The lawn sprinkler heads hissed, wetting the sidewalk. Schmeeker's black charger, with its red NRA bumper sticker, was already parked in his spot, which was marked by a similar sign that read, "Vice President." With morning had come clarity. He was still the president of North Lake Bank. He could get a short-term loan to consolidate his debts. He would call Carol to apologize. It was all manageable. He pulled open the front doors, fully re-inhabiting the persona of the competent and successful bank president, the man invited to speak about his successes around the Midwest. He was, truly, among the very best at what he did, and that counted for something. Sandy smiled up at him. "Sandy?"
"Good morning, Mr. White. Mr. Jorgensen's here to see you."
"Jorgensen?" That was a strange bit of news. J.W. walked back to his office to deposit his things on his desk. He wondered what could have caused Jorgensen to make the 4-hour drive and arrive by 9 in the morning, when he had just seen him yesterday afternoon. J.W. snugged his tie and headed for the conference room, a wood-paneled space centered by a long table. Its red surface was rich with morning light slanting in through wooden blinds. Jorgensen sat at the far end, poring over some papers.
"Frank, is something wrong?"
Jorgensen looked up from the paperwork. His face was inscrutable.
"Close the door, John."
J.W. corrected course, surprised at Jorgensen's tone.
"Sure."
He closed the door and touched the button to turn the blinds down slightly, as a courtesy more than anything, and began walking between the wall of windows and the long table.
"Everything all right?"
"No, John, I'm afraid it's not." Jorgensen set the papers down and sat back as he neared.
"I didn't sleep last night. I got up at 4 in the morning just to come and see you, so I could find out what's going on up here."
J.W.'s heart sped up. Had he discovered the loan?
"I don't understand."
Jorgensen picked up his smartphone and thrust it toward J.W. The screen glowed with colors.
"Take a look at that."
J.W. took it and examined the image. Two men pored over a roll of blueprints spread over the hood of a truck. Behind them rose the pale ribs of a new building. He was surprised to recognize one of the men.
"That's Johnny Eagle, the one from your talk yesterday. And he's at the building site that Sam Schmeeker's been emailing me about, the one that's going up on the edge of town. Just took that this morning."
J.W. looked up at him. Jorgensen was clearly irritated.
"What else do you know about him?" he asked.
J.W. put the phone down. He didn't, really. Not much more than the story in his presentation. Moved back to the reservation after his wife died, a little over a year ago. He pulled his right cuff farther down his wrist. His white shirt and collar felt constricting under his jacket, as if they had become twisted somehow.
"Have you been keeping track of this building project?" said Jorgensen.
"There have been some grumblings about it at the Sunrise Rotary, but..." He hadn't paid any particular attention. They had just started putting it up 10 days ago or so.
"It's on the edge of the reservation. They haven't announced what it is yet," he said.
"Last year when he was in here, was it a tribal loan he was after?"
J.W. shook his head.
"No, I would have approved that. It was for his house, an addition, remodel or something, and some kind of small business."
Jorgensen nodded, thinking about it.
"You know, he used to be a vice president at one of our competitors in Minneapolis," he said. "A real climber. They called him the Indian Obama."
J.W. saw the implication. He picked the phone back up and thumbed through some of the other images.
You think it's a bank? Jorgensen looked both worried and aggressive, like a bear about to strike.
You tell me.
J.W. finished thumbing through the images. The structure did seem to have preparations for a drive-through canopy. We'd lose the tribal deposits, he said, setting the phone back on the table. Jorgensen nodded.
Yeah, and that would probably put this branch out of business. I bet that's his intent.
Do you know how much Capital Bank Holdings paid for this branch?
No.
He wanted to sit, but Jorgensen hadn't asked him to, and he sensed that it would anger him.
$8 million. And you built it higher since.
J.W. suddenly realized how damaging such a development would be to Jorgensen's CEO campaign. If a tribal bank put Jorgensen's flagship branch out of business, they would lose millions of dollars, and his entire strategy for growth near casinos would be called into question. J.W. and everyone who worked here would be out of a job and permanently blemished by the failure. It would be a blow to the entire community.
You're the expert on this, John. Christ, you teach it, said Jorgensen. How many tribe-owned banks are there?
Not many. They'd need a state or federal charter to do it. Jorgensen looked at him for a moment as if contemplating something, then nodded faintly.
If you took a leave, do you think you could get your arms around this thing for us?
A leave? J.W. was shocked.
Frank, I've got my hands full as branch president.
Well, actually. Jorgensen slid a piece of paper out from beneath the stack of financial reports he had been reviewing and pushed it across the table to J.W.
I've been looking into some of your loans. One in particular.
J.W. picked it up, noticing how the embossed recorder's seal caught the light. He saw his signature, along with the forgeries of Sam's and Sandy's as the notary public. It was the second mortgage on his home. The $100,000 figure suddenly looked staggering. He felt a wave of nausea.
What's the problem? It's my second mortgage. That's what banks do. They improve people's lives.
John, come on, okay? You've been waiving your payments for almost a year.
J.W. laughed.
You know Carol. Her redecorating. Jorgensen slapped the table.
Everybody knows you've got a gambling problem and that you and Carol are separated over it.
Christ, I used to run this branch. You think I don't still have connections? I also know you're being evicted from your apartment, so let's cut the and you give me some honest answers.
Frank, it's just a little gaming.
This is embezzling, Jorgensen said, stabbing the papers with his fingers.
Put your keys on the table. I'm going to call the FBI.
J.W. hesitated.
Now.
J.W. felt sick and paralyzed.
You have been listening to Episode 4 of Sins of Our Fathers by Sean Lawrence Otto. The novel will be presented in a total of 23 episodes. If you miss any, you can catch up on our website, ktwh.org. Choose Programs and then Literally from the North Shore from the drop-down list. Please join us again next time for Episode 5 of Sins of Our Fathers, here on Literally from the North Shore.